if there's some macroeconomic event that hurts us. Yeah, exactly what you said. We may not hit our IRR targets because IRR is very sensitive on time periods. For right. longer time period, IRR drops. But I always say, you're still going to do better in a real estate investment over 10 years than if you were in the stock market during that same period, right. or if you were in some other asset class during that period. So yeah, I can't guarantee you that this is going to be a home run deal. But what I can say is, it's, if there's something bad that happens macroeconomically, it's still probably going to be a better investment than whatever your alternatives were.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Jay Scott, he goes by Jay. Probably many of you know him. He's an entrepreneur, investor, advisor, author, and partner at Bardown Investments. He's focused on buying and repositioning large multifamily properties. Now, Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate you having me.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. Same three questions I ask every guest on the show. Can you tell me in 90 seconds or less, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, I started as a corporate guy. I was in tech for a long time in Silicon Valley, 2008. I met my wife and we decided to get married, quit the 80-hour weeks and go off on our own. We ended up doing more than the 80-hour weeks for a long time, as anybody in real estate can probably tell you, but at least we were doing it for ourselves instead of somebody else. 2008 to 2017, did a lot of single family, flipped several hundred houses, about 400 houses, bought a bunch of rentals, got completely burned out from single family, and 2018 jumped into multifamily with my now partner, Ashley Wilson at Bardown Investments. And for the last couple of years, I've been focused on buying and repositioning large multifamily real estate assets.
That's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, you said you did 400 houses, was that, or 200 houses?
Somewhere, we lost track at like 300, but we did somewhere over 400.
That's a lot of houses. That's a lot of moving pieces. What were some of the problems you ran into that you finally just said, man, this is not for me anymore?
Single family is tough because you get into this mindset that you can do it all yourself. And to some extent, you can. I mean, single family, it's not rocket science. There are a lot of moving parts, but I mean, it's basically, it's acquisitions, it's rehab, and it's disbursement, and obviously the raising money piece. And for most of us, we can do all of those pieces ourselves. Problem is, we probably shouldn't be. And so I started building a team, but it's very hard to scale single family, simply because just the nature of the business, you're turning a lot of inventory and it's very hands-on, and acquisitions and disbursements are pretty difficult. So we figured out how to scale it, but it was never fully automatable like a lot of businesses. And so we just got burned out after about 10 years and I was looking for some new challenges. And the thing I love about multifamily is that it really is a team sport. So it allowed me to focus on what I'm really good at and then surround myself with people who are really good at all the stuff I'm not.
That's interesting. I know you said you've forged a new partnership with Ashley. How did that come about? And then what are you doing? I know you said you want to kind of augment your surroundings to put other people who are better at things around you than what maybe what you are, so you can play to your strengths. So how have you done that?
Yeah. So when I left single family in 2017, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. I was looking at doing some other business stuff. I do some advisory work. And so I thought maybe I'd go back to tech and do some advising there. But I had all this cash sitting around that I really needed to deploy. And I'm a control freak. I trust a lot of other syndicators, but I don't really like turning my money over passively to other people just because of my personality. I like to control my investments. And so in 2017, I said, I got all this cash. What can I do with it? And the obvious choice, because I know real estate, I love real estate. I thought real estate had a good trajectory for the next decade, was multifamily. But again, I didn't like the idea of turning my money over to somebody else. So I thought, well, what if I go into multifamily myself? I can operate the deals. I can raise money from others to do these large deals, but I can also invest alongside them. So basically, I'm both on the GP side and the LP side. And so when I decided to do that, my first thought was, well, if I'm going to be doing these big deals, I'm going to be taking money from people and they're going to trust me with very large amounts of money. And I was doing that in the single family world, but I trusted my skills in single family. And I said, I'm not really confident taking other people's money until I really know the business. So I reached out to Ashley, who is somebody I'd known for several years. She'd been doing multifamily for a long time. She was by far one of the best asset managers I've ever met. And I said, look, give me a year. Teach me. I'll give you a year of my time, a year of my effort, a year. You can have access to my network. You can have access to my money. You can have access to everything I have. Just spend a year mentoring me and teaching me the business, and I'll give you that in return. And she said, absolutely. And so we kind of set up this 1 year mentorship / partnership. And a year in, we got our first big deal that I was kind of a junior partner on the deal. And it went really well. And what we realized was we had a lot of complementary skills. There's things she was really good at and then other stuff she hated doing. There was stuff I was really good at and stuff I hated doing. And there was very little overlap in the stuff we were good at. And there was very little overlap in the stuff we hated doing. And so at that point, she said, hey, how would you feel about coming on as a partner? And I was thrilled. So we kind of relaunched the business, 50-50 partners, and now we're off and away buying property.
That's really intriguing. I mean, that's a long, I'm going to use the word dating period in business. I mean, to go an entire year, it took you a year to get a deal closed, right?
Yep.
I mean, that's one, that's a long runway. What do you say to that, to people who are out there trying to get their foot in the space? I mean, that's a lot of work and very little reward.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, there's different ways of doing this business. I know operators out there that are doing 5, 10, 15 deals a year. We're not opposed to doing 5 or 10 deals a year, but because one of the tenets of our business is we typically do large investments within our deals. So last deal, the one we have one closing literally today, where the operating team has $2 million invested in the deal. So we make probably almost as much, if not more money on the passive side as we do as operators. Right. And so for us, scale is less important than doing great deals. And I'm not saying that's true for everybody. There are some operators out there that can do scale because they've got a great pipeline and they've built relationships over long years and whatever. So I'm not saying ours is the only way to do it. But for us, we'd rather do fewer deals that are solid deals because we're putting our own money in there than do more deals and scale. And so if we do one deal a year, like 2020, we did one deal. 2021, we did none. This year, we've got one closing. It's now February 1st. We've got one closing today, one closing next month. So we could do 3 or 5 or 10 this year. But we really just let the market kind of tell us, dictate to us how many deals we do, and we're comfortable with whatever that number is.
Right. That's fantastic. Was there any desire, I guess, earlier on to speed up the formalization of your business where it was like, man, we've been going out this 6, 8 months, and where are we going with this?
So when I joined Ashley, so Ashley had a team, she had a functioning company, and so she was in the middle of several deals. It just so happened that it took about 8 to 10 months before we got to the point where she had a brand new deal in the pipeline that I could kind of be involved in from scratch. So I was involved in other deals. She had 1,000-some units prior to me joining, and I kind of jumped in and helped, but I didn't see the process all the way through until about 8 or 10 months. So we really did have a functioning business before I joined. But once I joined, we kind of formalized the partnership and we said, okay, let's think about how are we going to structure this business, not just for today, but for 5 or 10 years from now. What's our hiring plan going to look like? What's our marketing plan going to look like? What's our capital raising plan going to look like? How are we going to deal with HR and legal and accounting and all those other things that every other business, I mean, real estate, whether you're doing single family or multifamily or whatever you're doing commercial, it's a business. And you need to structure it like any other business. And you need an acquisition pipeline and you have inventory and you need to deal with HR and accounting and all of these other things. And so we sat down and we said, what is the business going to look like in 5 and 10 years? And how do we start growing it now so that we can naturally evolve to that point without major growing pains?
That's intriguing. I mean, it takes a lot of forecasting and a lot of imagination, if you will, to go, okay, what's this going to look like in 3 years? So what were some of the things you did? Besides just saying, what could this look like? Were there some concrete things or some resources used to say, hey, this is how we're going to plan for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing we did was we kind of divided and conquered. In any good business, it's difficult when there's not a clear division of responsibilities. Mm. So I've seen partners go in where everybody kind of tries to do everything and people step on each other's toes. There's a lot of infighting because people disagree on who makes the decisions ultimately or who the expert is. We started out by basically saying Ashley was going to do the stuff she was absolutely amazing at: asset management, acquisitions, networking. I was going to do the stuff I was great at, which was fundraising, and then all the analysis pieces, market analysis, underwriting, basically all the geeky spreadsheety stuff. And so once we decided that kind of she had her role and I had my role, that made things easy. Because at that point, she could then go and kind of do all the business planning to grow her areas of the business. Mm-hmm. I could go and do planning to grow my areas of the business. So what did that involve? That involved thinking about who the key hires were going to be. So in a year, who did we need on the team to basically be able to keep the pipeline filled and stay above water? In 5 years, was that team going to look like? What was the organizational structure going to look like? In 10 years, maybe. We didn't really think that far out. We tried to stay 3 to 5 years, but we had an idea of what does this business fully evolved and mature look like in 10 years? So at least we knew we were on the right path. Then we started documenting our processes. And this is something that I think a lot of entrepreneurs and investors could be really benefited from doing. Every time we did something, whether I sent an email to investors, whether I set up a marketing plan, whether Ashley went out and contacted a broker, we basically systematized it. And we set up a set of documentation for each of these things we do. So that way, if I'm going to be dealing with investors for the next year, and then I'm going to hire an investor relations person, I can basically hand off this documentation to the investor relations person and says, here's what my emails look like. Here's what the branding looks like. Here's what the type of voice I use when I talk to investors. Here's our communication plan. Here's all these other things. They can take over from me seamlessly. Investors don't necessarily even recognize that I've handed off this responsibility because the person coming on board has all my documentation of exactly how I do things, when I do things, where I do things. And so it's a seamless transition, not just for us on the team, but it's a seamless transition for our investors, our vendors, our customers, our brokers, everybody else that we relate to. And so we've been really big on making sure that we document our processes so that we stay consistent and everybody that we work with what to expect from us.
That's amazing. I mean, it's a tough, slow grind early on, right? To say, okay, I'm going to document this. Was there a software or a resource that you used that kind of helped you? I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, this is the email that I send on this day, but where did you stick that data to make it then repeatable?
Yeah, there's a lot of tools out there that, and I don't want to throw out any names because everybody has their favorites. I'm one of those people that I don't like tools. I come from technology. I worked for Microsoft for a long time. People think that I'm the biggest advocate of technology. But what I found is a lot of times, especially in non-technology businesses like ours, is that you can get bogged down in technology. You get these tools that have a billion features and you feel like you're supposed to use every one of them. Right. And so you spend half your day like putting information in a tool that you're never going to look at again, or organizing data in a way that just doesn't make sense because, oh, the tool does it. I've got to use it. And right. So for me, it's always, I start at the very beginning, and that's essentially Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel. And these days, I guess we use a lot of the Google tools instead of just so we can share. But at the end of the day, it's a spreadsheet and it's a Word document. And that handles 90% of what we do in our business because that's what other people are used to. I mean, again, you can use complicated tools. And if you've got a big business and you're comfortable with the tool, great. But I've always found that I'll pick a tool and it'll do half of what I need. And then I'm doing the other half in Word or Excel anyway. So I'd prefer to just do everything in Word.
Yeah. And I think that's great because you're absolutely right. There's so many of these softwares are designed for, you know, they're going to serve everybody in the world and they're going to have all these bells and whistles. And I've found that to be so true so often. You're like, I'm so bogged down in the minutia of using this software that it's not even serving the purpose for which I actually originally intended on using it. And that is nothing but frustrating.
I was just going to say, I've worked for some really big companies. I've worked for some Fortune 50 companies where most of their tools and data are not revolutionary. I mean, they're using basic tools because that's what works and that's what people are used to. And I'm not saying there's not a time and a place for a good tool, but don't feel like you have to use something because that's what makes you have a real business.
Right. And that's the other thing I think is when people think of scale, they commonly say, okay, well, I'm going to build a program or build something that will then allow me to scale and relieve the burden of X, Y, or Z. But I think especially early out or early starting out as you are scaling, the contrary to popular opinion, maybe I think you have to do things that are not scalable. Okay, well, you know, this is how we're doing it for now because it gets the job done in the most efficient, time efficient manner. Let's go, even though it may not be repeatable completely. So that's really intriguing. Talk to us about how you're finding opportunity. You guys said, hey, 2017, we're doing multifamily housing. I mean, even in 2017, there was the fear, the rumbling of like, man, are we going to have a correction, right? We're going on a 5 year, man, are we going to have a correction talk? How are you guys finding opportunity? And I know you said, since you guys are placing large amounts of capital in your own deals, like, how are you finding stuff that works for you?
everybody's always concerned about market cycles. I've written a book on economic cycles in real estate. So I'm certainly cognizant of the fact that the market's not always going up. But one of the nice things about multifamily, especially compared to single family, typical single family project is going to last 3 months or 6 months. Or if you're doing a big project, it might be 12 or 18 months if you're doing like ground up construction. In 3 months or 12 months or 18 months, the market can crush you. Right. The market can turn, and basically, if you don't have cash flow coming in because you're doing a flip or you're doing a new construction project, development project, basically the market can crush you. The nice thing about multifamily, because the cycles are much longer, we typically hold our projects for at least 3 to 5 years. And a lot of times we model them out to 8 to 10 years. It's unlikely that we're going to see a downturn that lasts 5, 8, 10 years. I mean, even 2008, which was a horrendous downturn, by 2013, the market had mostly recovered. And by 2018, 10 years later, we were hitting new highs. And so we model out these projects. One, we say, yeah, our primary exit strategy may be 3 years or 5 years, but we will always model out 8 to 10 years, thinking, okay, if there's a downturn, literally it starts the day we buy the property, where are we going to be 5 or 8 or 10 years down the road? Most likely we'll have recovered. And if we've modeled it correctly, we're generating cash flow throughout that time period. So unlike single family, where literally a market downturn can crush you and wipe you out, in multifamily and other commercial, if you're generating decent cash flow, and obviously if you have a project that has a huge amount of CapEx or is mostly vacant or needs tremendous turnover, you do run some risk because there may be some point of time where you're not generating a lot of cash flow. But if you have a plan to generate cash flow, even during a downturn, and we can talk about like why real estate tends to be less risky than other businesses in a downturn, if you have that cash flow, you can weather 3 or 5 or 8 years. And so for us, yeah, worst case, we invest and then a year later, the market turns down and interest rates go up and cap rates go up and values go down. Well, we're generating cash flow during that period. And in 5 or 6 or 8 years, we expect that the market will return. So basically, we have that mitigation plan kind of built into every project we do.
Yeah, I love that. That's something that I love, the fact that you pointed out the difference between single family and multifamily in this case, that, yeah, as a generated cash flow over that period, who cares what the valuation of it is, right?
Yep.
Who cares?
Exactly.
It's still producing an income. I don't care. Like, yeah, maybe we're not going to hit our IRR upon exit. Maybe, but as far as a risk removal strategy, I think that's really sound.
I mean, what we tell our investors is if there's an economic shift or if there's some macroeconomic event that hurts us, yeah, exactly what you said. We may not hit our IRR targets because IRR is very sensitive on time periods. For right. longer time period, IRR drops. But I always say, you're still going to do better in a real estate investment over 10 years than if you were in the stock market during that same period, right. or if you were in some other asset class during that period. So yeah, I can't guarantee you that this is going to be a home run deal. But what I can say is it's if there's something bad that happens macroeconomically, it's still probably going to be a better investment than whatever your alternatives were.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And especially in these inflationary environments, one of the things that we've talked about a lot on this show is buying assets that produce an income that can be repriced over time. It's like, okay, well, and in a family, multifamily, every 12 months, you're rewriting leases.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you're at max, you're probably exposed to a 12-month window of an inflationary environment that then you can reprice, you know, into the future. So
absolutely.
That's really intriguing. Jay, thank you for your time today. This has been a blast. Appreciate you coming on today. Let's jump here into the final four questions. And you said earlier, maybe you didn't want to name any, so maybe I won't ask you to, but maybe you'll come up with a different answer. The microphone's yours. What is one tool or resource, think digital, software, something along those lines, you find you can't live without?
I'm going to throw out the two I did. So Microsoft Excel, Microsoft Word, or the Google version, Google Docs and Google Sheets and QuickBooks. I'm a big fan. Basically, your business can be summed up by your numbers, your balance sheet, your P&L. And so I tell every investor out there, look, you may not be an accountant, you may not be a numbers guy or girl, but if you're not, hire somebody either full-time or part-time that can put all of your numbers, all of your financial data into whether it's QuickBooks or Quicken or whatever it is, so that you can see how your business is performing, not just today, but today compared to last year and next month compared to last month. Because at the end of the day, it's just like going and getting blood work done at the doctor. The numbers that come back is an indication of your health. Right. And your financial numbers are an indication of your business health.
Yeah. And the cost to do that. So, I mean, to get a qualified bookkeeper anywhere in the country, I mean, it's going to cost you 25 to 45 bucks an hour to get somebody that knows their stuff inside and out. So if you don't know it like me, I absolutely hire that out. It's like, okay.
And if you have investors, let me tell you something. When you can rattle off like all your financial information about your projects and your company, that builds trust because they want to know that you know that information and you know that information cold. Yeah. So have it at your fingertips.
Love it. What's one mistake you can help our listeners avoid and how would you avoid it?
Yeah. So biggest mistake I've made in this business was selling too much. So I remember sitting down in 2009 when I first started flipping houses with an investor in my area. And I said to him, he was pretty successful. I said to him, what was the biggest mistake you made so I can avoid it? And he said, biggest mistake I ever made was every property I've ever sold. And I kind of laughed. I was flipping houses at the time. I was making a lot of money flipping houses at the time. And so I kind of ignored him. 10 years later, I look back and those 400 flips, I did a rough estimate in 2018. Had I held every one of those, and obviously I couldn't have helped everyone, but let's say I held every one of those flips I did, that would have been another $35 million in my pocket. And so I look back and I thought, well, what if I just would have kept half of them or a quarter of them or a fifth of them? I mean, that's literally millions or tens of millions of dollars. And so basically what I tell everybody that's starting out in this business, there's this allure to doing transactions, to buying and selling. But at the end of the day, you make money over time through cash flow appreciation, the tax benefits of holding long-term. You don't get tax benefits from flipping houses. And so I would recommend to everybody out there, don't make the mistake I did, which was I sold everything I ever bought and thought that pot of cash was going to be good.
Right. Man, that's a painful lesson. Thanks for sharing that with us. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
We do everything we can to get involved in our communities where we are, where we're investing. So whether it be donating money to public parks around where we're investing or holding community activities on our property, barbecues and things like that, we try to integrate our business with the surrounding community. Part of it is because we like to do good for the community, but part of it's just pure selfishness because when we're integrated into the community, that's good for our business as well. And what's good for our business is good for our investors.
I love it. Jay, if our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, they can go to www.connectwithjscott, just the letter J.com, www.connectwithjscott.com. And that'll link you out to everything you need to know about me and also my email.
Awesome. Thank you, Jay, for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.